tonight's story. Sorry.
Yes.
August is a good time for killing here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. And this is Ms. G bringing you Telling Tales. I will be right back with tonight's story, so stay tuned. And this is Ms. G, and I'm back with August is a Good Time for Killing by Joyce Harrington. August is a good time for killing, the old woman said, peering solemnly over the honeysuckle. There must have been shock on my face, for she added quickly, I mean weeds, of course. Of course, I agreed just as quickly. I knew she meant weeds. What else could she mean? There's not much else to do in the garden in August. Strawberries are finished, peas are petering out. Tomatoes are still bearing, but they're tired. Killing is the only thing. The peas were awfully good. Thank you again. Was it true that she was a witch? Josh had refused to eat the peas, said they were poisoned, and he didn't want to get turned into a frog or fall asleep for a zillion years. Fact of the matter was that Josh hated peas, canned, frozen, or fresh from Mrs. Abel's garden. Peter ate four and survived. I had eaten the rest, greedily enjoying every mouthful. I love fresh peas. Mrs. Abel couldn't have sent over a more welcome gift. And now I wish I could uneat them somehow. The ghost of those peas was rising in my throat and fuddling my brain, making it difficult to think or speak with any sense at all. Maybe they were bewitched. You should put those boys to work, she said. And the honeysuckle is a good place to start. You have to cut it back quite severely. If you don't, it will take over. But it's so beautiful. I don't mind if it does take over. The boys thought you were offering them a job to help you in your garden. Nonsense. I've gardened for years without a stitch of help. I'm certainly not going to start needing it now. But the honeysuckle is growing over onto your side. It's my honeysuckle, so I'm willing to take the responsibility for cutting it back. The least you could do is make your boys pull up the runners. They'll be all over the place if you don't. I assume you're too busy to do it yourself. What could I tell her? Everything she said was a challenge. We seemed to be an affront to her sense of order. A young woman and her two sons living without benefit of a man around the house. Not unusual in New York City, but obviously not quite respectable in this quiet backwater town. Was I being too sensitive? Was Mrs. Abel mean and spiteful to everybody? Was she, as Josh and Peter insisted, a witch? Well, I am pretty busy, I said. I'm working on a book. And instantly felt queasy and self-conscious, as if I just mouthed some lame excuse for not having my homework done. I knew she had been a schoolteacher. So I heard. She dismissed my labors with those three words. It's always been my experience with boys that if you keep them busy, they won't have time to get into mischief. I taught school for 50 years, you know. So I heard. My sarcasm was wasted. She plowed on with her dreadful philosophy of how boys should be handled. It wasn't much different from her attitude toward honeysuckle. She must have warped a lot of young minds in her day. You must always keep the upper hand with boys. Now girls are much easier to control. Oh, once in a while you'll get a wild one. She eyed me speculatively. But for the most part, you can handle girls with a system of rewards for good behavior. Bribery, I thought, just like the peas. I always made sure the boys in my classes had plenty of work to do, and I wasn't afraid to use the paddle. Were they afraid of you, I asked. They respected me, she replied. Lots of them come to visit me now that I've retired. They don't forget, Mrs. Abel. They come to me for advice with their own children, and I tell them just what I told you. Don't be afraid to enforce hard work and strong discipline. I was dying to get away, but I didn't want to be rude. and a kind of horrid fascination glued me to my side of the honeysuckle hedge and kept me prompting her for more. "Did you have any children of your own?" I asked. "No. I've been a widow for a long time. I never thought once about remarrying after Mr. Abel died. He never came back from the Great War. They never even found his body. I have a flag. I raise it on Memorial Day." She sounded as if the flag gave her more pleasure and less trouble than the living man might have done. "Now, your husband," she went on, "he must have been a handsome man. The boys are quite good-looking. They don't resemble you at all." I stared at the wart on Mrs. Abel's chin. Every witch worth her eye of newt has a wart on her chin. Mrs. Abel's had the requisite 3 long hairs growing out of it. "He still is a handsome man. We're divorced." "So much of that nowadays." She wagged her head and the corners of her mouth dripped sadness. "It's always the children who suffer." "The boys aren't suffering. They're having the time of their lives." What a talent the woman had for raising hackles. She'd neatly put me on the defensive in the most vulnerable area of my already shaky emotional fortifications. "It'll show up later," she assured me. "Mark my words, you'll have your hands full." Mrs. Abel spoke in cliches, but she imbued them with such eager ill will, such certainty of disaster, that I found myself glancing nervously over my shoulder to see if maybe Josh and Peter had emerged from the woods dripping blood or trailing broken limbs. The early afternoon continued blamelessly still and sun-filled. Bees and squirrels went about their business. "Well," I said, "back to work. It's been nice chatting with you." And what exactly did I mean by that? It was horrible chatting with her. Was I trying to be charming and disarming so she wouldn't cast an evil spell on me? I crossed the yard, feeling her flat eyes boring malvoyantly into the back small of my back. It made me walk funny, as if my legs had turned to stilts. Our house is a dingy, white, clapboard affair, squatted at the edge of a little upstate town near a shallow creek in a pleasant wooded area. It is small, in need of paint, and its facilities are primitive, but the rent is cheap, and as a sanctuary from the havoc of divorce and the hustle of the city, it is perfect. The screen door shrieked as I entered my sanctuary. The manuscript glared at me from a rickety card table at one end of the screened porch. Blank yellow paper rolled onto the platen of my old Olivetti, issued its challenge. The book, while not precisely the cause of the divorce, had played its part in the final breakup. It had been all right as I just diddled around writing an occasional clever little story for clever little magazines. Hal could afford to be proud and say, "This is my wife. She writes." But as soon as the writing got serious, as soon as I got the grant from the endowment and really started working on the book, as soon as the cooking fell off and the laundry got behind and dust accumulated on the hi-fi, Hal started obstructing me. In little ways at first, like calling me up from the office when he knew I was working and telling me his gray suit had to be taken to the cleaners immediately, or inviting hordes of people over for dinner on the day after I'd done the weekly shopping so I'd have to dash out and do it all over again and spend the rest of the day cooking, and be hungover and worn out the next day so there were 2 days lost from the book. It grew from an accumulation of petty annoyances to a monster bristling with lawyers, recriminations, hurt pride, and no return ticket. I sighed and settled down in my swivel chair. I swiveled once, viewing my domain. Plants in pots helped hide the lack of paint. At one side of the porch, a lumpy daybed undulated beneath a bright Indian coverlet. I would make some pillows soon, turn the place into a regular den of oriental luxury. Maybe even put a priceless Persian rug on the splintery floor. I might even oil the hinges on the screen door after I sold the book. I swiveled back to the Olivetti and groped for a thought. "Ma, Ma, Josh found a dead body." Peter came screeching across the yard. "That's nice," I mumbled. "Ma, Ma, no kidding." Peter pounded up the stairs and through the screen door, letting it slam behind him. The whole porch shook, and the Olivetti inched closer to the edge of the table. "There's an old dead guy in the woods. Josh is guarding him." I shoved back from the typewriter and stared, disbelieving, at my younger son. Dead guys did not turn up in peaceful woods outside of lurid fiction. Or could this be some of Mrs. Abel's witchery in action? Oh my, it's real weird. This old guy is in a cave and he has a long beard and he smells funny. Peter was hopping up and down with fearful excitement. Stay calm, I told myself, and calmly said to him, maybe I'd better take a look. I followed Peter across the yard and into the quiet aisles between the trees. How strange to be walking through August woods, trailing my capering child, played on by rays of tinkling sunlight toward the possibility of a corpse. This couldn't be happening. And it was not. When we reached the cave, a steepled indentation beneath two slabs of angled rock, the corpse was sitting up and talking to Josh. Sure, we got bears. Ain't you heard 'em? They come in the night. Come for bacon, beans, and boys. Beans and bacon they like to eat. What do you think they want with boys? Don't believe you, Josh challenged. I ain't seen no bears. Any bears, I corrected automatically, and don't say ain't. Josh shrugged and kicked at a rock. Who are you? I asked the revenant. The bearded, funny-smelling, no-longer-dead old guy scrambled to his feet, knocking his head against the overhanging roof of his cave. Morning, ma'am. Afternoon. How do you do? Luther's who I am. You's living in my house. Your house? He was not old beneath his effluvium of cheap wine. I would guess around 40. His beard was patchy black and gray, his arms long, sinewy, and tanned. He wore a ribbed undershirt splotched with wine and sweat stains, gray pinstriped trousers that had come down in the world, and a pair of out-at-the-pinky-toe sneakers. Yes, ma'am. I was living in that house. Miss Abel said I could. Then she said I had to leave, because yous was coming. How long did you live there? The question seemed to puzzle him. He gazed off into the rustling top of the trees and scratched absently at the back of his head. Where do you live now? He shrugged and glanced over his shoulder at the tiny cave. In it there lay a grimy quilt, the batting poking through the ancient calico, an empty muscatel bottle, and a shabby zippered satchel. Can you paint a house, Luther?
I can paint,
he said, nodding energetically. I did paint for Ms. Abel. She give me $2. Said I want worth no more than that. I can wash windows, set traps, too.
For bears?
Ain't no bears around here. His bloodshot eyes swiveled around at me, pityingly, as if I were loony. Rabbits, mostly. I gets 25 cents apiece. His tongue flicked out to lick dry lips, and he turned to gaze longingly at the empty bottle. The boys had lingered until it was certain that Luther was neither corpse nor ghost, and then they'd scampered away toward the creek. I could hear them whooping and splashing. Luther hung before me, loose-limbed and expectant. What now? I thought of the small building at the back of the yard. No more than a shed, really, designated by the rental agent as a wash house. I had done no more than poke my head into it and retained a hazy collection of a stone tub with a single faucet, a rusty gas ring, and a single light bulb hanging from a frayed black cord. Not much, but better surely than a cave in the woods. Was I about to hire a resident handyman? It would be nice to have the house painted. Painting was not included in the lease. It would be nice to get on with the book. I couldn't do both. Luther, would you like to paint my house?
Yes, ma'am.
Would you like to live in the wash house?
Yes, ma'am.
I'll pay you. I hesitated over naming an amount. Best wait and see what kind of a painter Luther turned out to be, although anything would be an improvement. As if he could read my mind, Luther stated proudly, I paint real good. Fine, I said. You can move into the wash house this afternoon. It needs to be cleaned up, and so do you. Then we'll go into town and buy some paint. I walked away, leaving Luther to round up his belongings and say goodbye to his cave. It had always been a tenet of my city life that winos were harmless. Repugnant, maybe, and a sad waste of good human material, but basically no threat at all. Luther had a quality of childlike simplicity. No, not childlike. Children are far from simple. I set a broom, a bucket, some soap, and a towel outside the wash house, and for the third time that day, confronted my typewriter. It must have been several hours later that I became aware of a tentative scratching at the screen door. The sun threw a long shadow across my yellow paper. Luther stood on the porch steps, transformed. He wore white painter's overalls, clean but flecked with many colored drips of paint. His face, bereft of beard, shone red above and white below, his chin oozing blood from tiny razor nicks. Good Lord, I hadn't asked him to shave. Time to get paint, he said. Right you are, I agreed. The book was alive again, running through the typewriter like a wild thing. I could be generous with my time. The boys trailed across the yard, obviously about to utter their eternal plaintive cry. I'm hungry, Ma. Hurry up, I called to them. We're going into town. Can we eat at McDonald's? Why not? In the hardware store, the proprietor eyed me curiously as I shuffled through paint chips. The boys prowled, fascinated by nails and barrels and nuts and bolts in little wooden drawers with curved brass handles. It was an old-fashioned hardware store that carried the very latest in power tools and electrical appliances alongside stacks of mason jars and rows of kerosene lamps. Luther clutched a bright red paint chip and stared at his sneakers as if already beyond hope that anything so beautiful could be his to work with. White, I said, and some brushes and whatever else we need. A ladder, I guess. I can rent you an extension ladder, ma'am. No sense in buying one of those. The proprietor beamed at me with kindly, fat-cheeked goodwill. Luther doing the job for you? Yes. I looked around for the boys. They were hypnotized by a display of flashlights. What is it about boys and flashlights? I decided I would let them each choose one. Luther's a good enough painter. The proprietor's rich, jolly voice called me back to the business at hand. But he's slow. The man tapped the side of his head significantly. Luther continued to stare at his sneakers. The hand holding the red paint chip began to shake. And he has some funny ideas about color. Well, just look at him. I bet he's thinking it would be real nice to paint your whole house fire engine red. Crazy. The man spoke as if Luther were deaf or so deficient in understanding that he could say any cruel thing without penetrating to a nerve. But if you want to get the job done, just make sure he stays off the bottle. Right, Luther? Luther's mouth twisted into a witless, wet grin. He said, bub, bub, bub. His eyes filmed over into a semblance of idiocy. We'll paint the house white, I said, but there's no reason why we can't have a red door. Let me have a can of this. I took the red paint chip from Luther's shaking hand and waved it at the hardware man's complacent smirk. Yes, ma'am, he said. Later, with the painting gear stowed in the trunk and the ladder secured to the roof of the car, Luther's face returned to normal. Normal? The boys in the back seat shone their flashlights into each other's eyes and threatened mutual mayhem. Luther said, time to eat. McDonald's, here we come. We carried our hamburgers and french fries home. I was not about to subject Luther to any more of the mindless bullying I had witnessed in the hardware store. It was for my own protection as much as for his. He had evolved his means of dealing with it, turning himself into a slack-jawed, drooling caricature of a mental defective. But I couldn't bear to watch that awful transformation again. We ate in the twilight backyard, Luther and the boys munching in companionable silence, while I pondered how I had managed to appoint myself protector of the downtrodden. It was totally out of character. I was far from overprotective with the boys and not notable for coddling my husband, my ex-husband. What was there about this alcoholic reject that evoked my righteous indignation? Was that all it was, or was I, oh, God forbid, infected with missionary zeal? Did I have some inane notion that I could reform him, educate him, bless his life with meaning? Maybe he had all the meaning he could handle. The boys crammed the last of the french fries into their mouths and swooped off, shrieking across the darkening lawn, drawn by the wildly flailing beams of their flashlights. Luther gathered up the greasy papers, methodically wadding them into the smallest possible bundle. Time to paint now? No, it's too dark. You can start in the morning. Don't pay no mind to that Ms. Abel. Luther never did no wrong thing. Mrs. Abel has never mentioned you, Luther. Now I want to get some more work done. Good night. As I entered the screen porch, I heard Luther's disjointed mumble fading across the yard to the wash house. Paint in the morning. Get up early. Ms. Abel is ugly. This one is pretty. Paint the door red. Nice. Ms. Abel better not tell. Tell what, I wondered, and then forgot as my fingers flew over the keys. In the morning, I awoke to the sound of scraping. It was barely light, and a fuzzy mist floated about 2 feet off the ground. It made the ladder seem to rise from incalculable depths up the side of the house, and, for all I could tell, extend all the way to heaven. The scraping came from somewhere above. My little bin wind-up alarm clock said 5:45, and my bed felt clammy from the tendrils of mist that had crept onto the porch and fingered my lumpy bedding. I scrambled into my robe and went outside. Luther was on the ladder, a great white bird of pure light, elbows flapping as he scraped away old paint blisters from the flanks of the house. "Time to paint now," he beamed down at me. "Time to paint, Luther." I went inside to plug in the coffee pot. Time for the book, too, before the boys woke up. I left Cheerios and bananas on the kitchen table for them. The scraping from above melted into a rhythmic slap-slap, which in turn blended into the tap-tap of words arranging themselves on paper. I vaguely heard the boys clanking spoons on bowls and then clump past me to offer their services to Luther. Good, I thought. Let him teach them how to paint a house. Just a few more lines and then on to the next chapter. Then I leaped at an imperative rapping on the screen door and whirled to see who was barging into my morning. It was Mrs. Abel. "May I come in? I have to talk to you." Her wart pulsed with secrets to unfold. I opened the door and she creaked through. "Can we talk in the kitchen? I don't want him to hear." She rolled her eyes upward and I wondered if she meant Luther or God. We went into the kitchen. The boys had left behind a crunching of spilled sugar and some flaccid O's in milky puddles. Mrs. Abel tiptoed around a shriveled banana peel. "I thought I ought to warn you," she mouthed, making up in exaggerated lip movements which she lacked in volume. Her teeth were long and yellow. "About what?" I mouthed back at her. "Luther, I see he's painting for you." "Right. He seems to know what he's doing." "Oh, he's a good enough painter." "A bit slow, I know, but I'm in no hurry." "That isn't what I came to tell you. Frankly, I hoped I wouldn't have to tell you this. Luther was supposed to go stay with his brother. I told him to go. He's never disobeyed me before." "First time for everything." "What?" Her flat eyes suspected irreverence, but she carried on. "As far as I knew, he went. His brother lives on the other side of town. Luther always has a home there whenever he chooses to appear." She stopped her breath and to marshal her thoughts. "Coffee?" I asked. "What? Oh, yes, please. 2 sugars, no milk." "Luther killed a boy." Coffee slopped into the saucer and from there over my thumb and onto the gritty linoleum. "I didn't mean to startle you," she smiled, "but truth is truth and must be told. Now that you've got yourself mixed up with him." "I'm not mixed up. He's only painting the house." "And living in the wash house. I saw him hanging his quilt out to air." "But of course you couldn't know anything about what happened here 30 years ago. You couldn't know the danger you're in or your boys." She sipped coffee primly and smacked her thin lips. Either my coffee was to her liking or her story was making her mouth water. One thing was certain, her evil was infectious. I wanted to rush out of the house and snatch Josh and Peter away from the contaminated person of the house painter. But a small voice said, "Wait a minute. Find out what really happened." "What happened?" I asked 30 years ago. "What happened was that a boy who lived in this house, about 8 years old, isn't your younger boy about that age, was drowned in the creek. He used to go fishing and trapping with Luther, and then one night he didn't come home for dinner. Luther was about 10 years old then, living at home with his mother and father just down the road. They've passed on since. He was a child of their old age, a mistake if you ask me, and he never was very bright. Well, the parents of the missing child were very upset, and a search was organized. They found Luther first in a little cave in the woods. Oh, he was a mess, crying and blubbering and making less sense than usual. He never did have any backbone. I remember him carrying on the same way over an arithmetic problem. Anyway, all they could get out of him was that he didn't do it and he didn't know who did it. Well, that made them search even harder, and eventually they found the boy. Bobby Albright was his name, face down in the creek. They say you can drown in a teacup, but it's always been my opinion that you would need a little help. I've always believed that Luther held Bobby's face in the water. What did the police say? Accident, she snapped. Accident. There was a lump on poor Bobby's head, so they guessed he fell on a rock and drowned while unconscious. But I knew better. Why do you suppose Luther took it so hard? Guilt, pure and simple. But why would Luther do such a thing? You and I need reasons, my dear, but Luther is different. He was a willful, disobedient child, one of those who stubbornly refused to learn anything, and no amount of paddling could make him a good student. Well, I just wanted to let you know what kind of person you have painting your house. If I were you, I'd keep my doors and windows locked at night. Wait a minute, I said. If he's so dangerous, why did you give him permission to camp out in this house while it was vacant? Oh, he's no danger to me. I know how to handle him. The owners asked me to keep an eye on the house, and what better way to prevent vandalism than to let it be known that crazy Luther might be lurking about the premises? Has he ever done anything else? No. But who knows what he might do when he's full of wine? Well, I suppose you're busy. She glanced pointedly around my untidy kitchen, and Lord knows I have plenty of work to do. I stood at the screen door and watched her wade laboriously across the yard. What's worse than a witch, I thought. I hoped I wouldn't have too many more visitations from Mrs. Abel now that she's sown her vile seeds of ancient gossip. With half an ear, I listened to the slapping at the side of the house and the low murmur of Peter's voice telling one of his favorite stories. So Dorothy had to get the broomstick, but she got caught by the flying monkeys. You got to hold the brush like this, came Luther's voice, and go this way, back and forth. And they all came to save her, and they all ran all over the castle. And then Dorothy spilled a bucket of water on the witch, and she melted, and that was the end of her. And Josh, ever the realist and puncturer of his little brother's balloons, said, the wizard was a fake, and it was all only a dream. But Mrs. Abel is a real witch, and she'll get you. If you only knew, I thought. And went to take a shower, hoping to dispel the heavy sense of oppression that my visitor had left behind. Later that evening, I paid Luther for his day's work. The front and one side of the house were finished except for the trim, and the boys had spent a glorious day covering themselves with paint. As I handed him a $10 bill, his eyes shifted to the little house beyond the honeysuckle hedge. Mrs. Abel came here this morning, he stated. Yes, she did. She told you things about Luther. I wouldn't lie to him, but I wondered how much I could safely tell him. I suspected that he was only crazy north by northwest, but I wasn't ready to bank on it. She told me about something that happened a long time ago, an accident. He nodded gravely and sloped off across the yard to the wash house. I wanted to call after him, let him know I was on his side, but if he didn't know that already, nothing I said would make any difference. That night I was very conscious of not locking my doors and windows. For a long moment, my hand hovered over the hook and eye bolt on the screen door. But then I reminded myself that this was not paranoid New York City. This was the safe, clean, all-American, true-blue small town of everyone's nostalgic dreams. Anyway, the flimsy hook wouldn't stop anyone determined to get in. I went to bed. For a long time, I lay listening to the sleepy murmurs of the boys in their nook under the eaves. After they quieted down, I listened to the hooting of owls and the rustling of trees in the mild night air. Once I got up and stared through the screen into the blackness of the backyard, I thought I had seen a flash of light from the direction of the wash house, but decided it must have been a firefly. At last I slept, but dreamed strange, struggling, blood-tinged dreams that kept me on the edge of consciousness, fading as soon as I opened my eyes. Toward dawn, I finally fell into exhausted and dreamless oblivion. I was awakened by the slap, slap, slap on the side of the house. It was mid-morning of a hot, humid day, and I'd lost precious hours from the book. I dressed quickly and went outside to see what progress the painters were making. I rounded the side of the house and stopped in shock. Luther on the ladder twisted around and waved to me, grinning and pleased with himself. The front of his white overalls were streaked and splashed with red. My knees went weak, and my empty stomach lurched. The boys were nowhere in sight. Where? My nightmares were coming true. Mrs. Abel was right. My mind leaped to horrid discoveries in the woods or behind the wash house. I stared up at Luther, wondering what to do next. "Painted the door already," he announced proudly. Josh pounded from around the front of the house and took my hand in a sticky one. "Come and see, Ma. It looks terrific." Peter followed, gripping a reddened paintbrush. Both boys were generously splattered with red paint. "Can we paint the stairs red, too?" "No, not the stairs. That would be too much red." It was already too much red for one morning, but I let them lead me around to the front of the house. The door had indeed been painted. Bright red and still tacky, it gleamed on the front of the house like the half-remembered blood stains of my dreams. "It looks very nice," I said, and tottered back into the house to plug in the coffee pot. While the coffee perked and I scrambled eggs, I chastised my hyperactive imagination. Was I going to let that vicious old woman distort my mind with her ugly suspicions? No, I was not. It occurred to me that her tale might be just that, a fabrication designed to frighten me into leaving. I didn't know what she had against me, but I wasn't going to be frightened out of my sanctuary. I called everybody in to breakfast. Luther ate with good appetite. The rest of the morning I spent organizing my notes and my own feelings. I didn't know what to make of Mrs. Abel's story, but if anybody ever needed a friend, it was Luther. If he'd really killed that boy, why hadn't the police found out about it? Mrs. Abel, it seemed so certain that he'd done it. Surely she would have told the police. They must have been satisfied that he was innocent, or at least not responsible. Why had she continued to believe him guilty for 30 years? And why try to frighten me off when all I was doing was giving him an honest day's work and a semblance of dignity? I was still puzzling over Mrs. Abel's purpose when I heard voices outside. I ran out and around the house to see who was there. Josh and Peter were huddled together at the corner of the house, being uncharacteristically quiet. When I appeared, they bolted for the porch, but I sensed their noses pressed to the screen from the inside. "Good morning," I said to the tall, dry man in the quasi-military uniform with the small American flag sewn in onto the sleeve. Luther stood dumb and downcast before him. There was no mistaking the family resemblance. Mrs. Abel had neglected to tell me that Luther's brother was a policeman. "Morning, ma'am," he said politely and deliberately removing his smoky bear hat. "I came to find Luther. I hope he hasn't been bothering you." I said what was obvious. "Luther's been painting my house." "Yes, well, there's more to it than that. I called Mrs. Abel earlier this morning. She always knows what he's been up to." My blood began to boil. "Luther hasn't been up to anything. Mrs. Abel is a vicious old busybody." I glanced at Luther. He was wearing his village idiot face, and his lips began to move in the slobbering bub, bub, bub I'd heard in the hardware store. "That may be," said his brother, "but she didn't answer her phone. I called 3 times, so I came on over to see for myself." "Luther's doing a job for me and doing it well. Are you satisfied?" "Not exactly." He turned to peer intently up the road toward the center of town. "The ambulance should be getting here soon. I called from over to her place." "Ambulance? What for? Is she sick?" "Not exactly. She's dead." His eyes, when they swung back to me, were a chilly gray. "May I use your phone?"
Sure.
"But wait a minute. What did she die of? Heart?" He paused with his hand on the screen door. I heard the boys scuffling away upstairs.
"You might say that. Somebody stopped it for her with a pair of hedge clippers."
Now that he'd opened up, I wanted him to stop, but he droned on in his official monotone. "Somebody threw a bucket of water on her, maybe trying to clean up the mess, just made it worse. She put up a fight, though. Somebody, likely, got a broomstick busted over his head. I got to make that phone call now." He went inside. Luther stood beside the ladder, the red stained front of his overall, glowing obscenely in the noonday sun.
"She's a witch," he muttered.
He took his painter's cap off and tenderly massaged the top of his head.
Luther, don't. Everybody was telling me things I didn't want to hear. I've thrown water on her, but she don't melt. She hit Luther with that broom. Luther hit her with
I sat down on the porch steps. Luther came closer, earnestly explaining. "She hit Bobby with that shovel. Bobby taken 2 tomatoes.
"What tomatoes? Who's Bobby?"
"Bobby fall down. She tell Luther help carry, put Bobby in the water. She say Luther never tell nobody or else go to jail forever. Luther didn't do no wrong thing. Bobby was Luther's friend."
She's a witch. She killed Bobby. It came together then, and I wanted to cry. But my tears wouldn't help Luther. The only thing I could do was respect his confidence and hope for the best. But what would be the best for Luther? To continue playing his role of village idiot, a role he was comfortable with, or to spend the rest of his life in some institution for the criminally insane? Not if I could help it by keeping his confession to myself. Mrs. Abel had got what was coming to her. Heavy footsteps shook the porch and the screen door screamed on its rusty hinges. I got up to face Luther's brother with what I hoped was a look of puzzled ignorance. "Ma'am," he said with exaggerated respect, "I just talked with the station. It seems they think they have a suspect." I looked at Luther. He had retreated behind his moronic facade. "It seems they picked up the stranger for speeding through town. It seems they put two and two together and came up with five." Doubt clouded his steely gray eyes as he glanced at his brother. "It seems they're holding him on suspicion." "Do you believe he did it?" "I don't know what to believe, ma'am. I truly don't. All I know for sure is that one old woman is dead, and I can't say I regret her passing. But it's my duty to find out who killed her." "And this stranger, this speeder, what about him?" My voice came strangely from my throat, taut and stifled. If I didn't speak, if I didn't betray Luther's confidence, would another man live, wasted years in the wake of Mrs. Abel's malvoyance? I couldn't speak. Only Luther could do that. I rolled on him, clutching his red, smeared sleeve. "Luther, tell him. Tell your brother what you told me." Bub, bub, bub. Wet lips and vacant eyes. He was gone. This was no role-playing. Luther had crossed the line to the only safety he knew. A gentle hand took my arm and held it firmly. "Ma'am," said the expressionless voice, "I know. Luther told me. I've been waiting 30 years for him to tell me. Now it's too late." I looked at the dry, creased face under the silvery brush cut. The gray eyes had lost their chill, and I saw there was a sadness deeper than any I had ever known. I felt tears in my own eyes then for Luther struggling dimly in his silent prison and for this man with the sad eyes who must finally crucify his brother. "Ma'am," the man's questioning voice reached through my sobs, "would it be all right with you if Luther finishes painting the house before I take him in? It would make him feel better, and I'll stay and keep an eye on him." "Yes, oh yes." I broke away and stumbled into the house. I had packing to do, all the clothes into all the duffel bags, all the toys, books, toothbrushes, the lid onto the typewriter. We would go back to the city, back to a world I knew well and could cope with, where violence and evil were anonymous and did not reach into my life with red hands, smearing me with indelible accountability. Josh and Peter stood one above the other on the narrow stairway, watching large-eyed and frightened as I swept through the house, indiscriminately tossing objects into boxes and bags. Whatever was handy. "Get your things together, boys," I shouted at them. "We're leaving." "Ah, Ma," said Josh, "can we help Luther finish painting?" I stopped in my tracks, one hand clutching a damp pair of swimming trunks. My children in their red stained jeans with streaks of red on their hands and arms and even in their hair were telling me something. It was, after all, only paint. Luther had been their friend. He still was. There was nothing to run away from. "I can't pack these. They're all wet." "Sure. Go and help Luther. We won't be leaving yet a while." On the outside of the house, the rhythmic slap of Luther's paintbrush is the most melancholy sound I have ever heard. You just heard me read Joyce Harrington's August is a Good Time for Killing. This is Ms. G with Telling Tales here at 104.3. Good night, until next time.